It is a privilege for me, of course, to have the opportunity to give a talk on a Thursday evening here. I don't do so very often. And in particular, this Thursday being the very first Thursday evening talk of the fall program season. So I get to roll the ball and start things going. And this evening I'm particularly happy to be talking about a topic that is obviously of great interest to everyone who have come, and obviously not of great interest to the many other people who did not come. But I think it's of interest to everyone because all human beings aspire to happiness. We all want to be happy. We may not know what will make us happy or how we can achieve that aspiration or that goal, but every human being has a deep yearning for the sense of well-being or a sense of inner happiness that makes one feel at ease with oneself and at ease with the world. However, it is difficult to achieve, and it seems to elude most of us most of the time. And I think when we consider our daily lives, most of us would have to kind of admit that we're troubled a good portion of the time. Troubled by events in the day, troubled by family issues, troubled by work issues, troubled by mostly our own minds. And so when I thought of a topic, I thought, you know, the Buddha's way to a trouble-free mind would make a good topic. And I took the liberty of creating this topic from the title of a discourse that the Buddha gave. As you know, the Buddha lived in India a very long time ago. And, well, one could question whether or not those teachings are still relevant and valid today, considering that we have advanced so much. But unfortunately, the human condition hasn't changed very much. The external environment may have changed considerably, but the human condition, the state of the heart, the mind, and just the problems of being alive on this planet, living with others, remain pretty much the same. And so this discourse was given by the Buddha, and the actual title of the discourse was The End of All Defilements, and it was a discourse given to the monks. And of course, you know, the teachings given to the monks may not be quite the sort of teachings that one would want to share with lay people, because monks live very specialized lives. I mean, really specialized. It's no fun. You know, people often, when they hear that I was a monk, they, oh, how wonderful. Yes, it is wonderful. I'm very grateful for it, but it's no fun. It is actually a very specialized life, very disciplined, based on renunciation, simplicity, and strict code of conduct, and all of it for the one purpose, to make one's life as streamlined as possible so that one can devote all of one's, or as much as possible of one's time and energy and concern to cultivate the spiritual path. And so monks do live very specialized lives that are quite different to the lives that we are living today. And these teachings were given to monks. So I'm not going to sit here and read this discourse to you in the hope that we're all going to be so inspired, oh, how wonderful, and go off and become monks and nuns. That's not the intention. However, there are some facets to this teaching that are relevant and can certainly be applied to life. And so rather than thinking about it in a very narrow way, I've tried to look at it in a very broad way. What is the Buddha presenting here? What guidelines to help people, one, explore and grow in the spirit, on the spiritual path, two, to free themselves from troubles. Troubles here meaning things that create problems in our lives, detract from our well-being, detract from the sense of harmony, detract from good health, detract from good mental health, happiness and joy. So I'm going to take great liberties with this discourse. I'm going to rearrange it, change the order of what he has pointed out. However, if you are interested in reading the actual discourse given by the Buddha, I greatly recommend this book, What the Buddha Taught, by Walpola Rahula, not to be confused with the other book, What the Buddha Never Taught, which is also not by this author, but is someone else. This one is a well-reputed book, and it does have a really good explanation of some of the essential characteristics and essential points of the Buddha's teachings. And he does have, at the end of the book, a number of the kind of more well-known or important discourses that the Buddha gave during his lifetime. And so one of them is listed here, getting rid of all cares and troubles, which is what I've rendered as getting rid of all mental, freeing the mind from all troubles. And so what the Buddha did in this discourse, he made a very important point, which is very pertinent. He said that freedom from troubles and cares, freedom from suffering is for those who know and see, not for those who do not know and do not see. And though this may sound a little esoteric, really all it's saying is, hey, you're not going to get rid of your troubles just accidentally. You've really got to work at it. It's for those who've taken the time to look closely at life, at oneself, at life's experiences, at the relationship between what we do and what comes of it, at the relationship between our aspirations and what we actually create in life. In other words, opening our hearts, opening our minds with this sense of wanting to discover, rather than being someone who is just content to be told, be it by the society, by the church, the institution, by the long accepted traditions of old, be they Buddhist or otherwise. It is not good enough to just read and memorize and accept. It requires that desire and that thirst for knowledge that is one's own realization, one's own understanding, one's own discovery. The others, that which comes from people speaking, books, traditions, are merely pointing, suggesting means and ways by which we can undertake this exploration. But in order to arrive at true knowledge and vision, to know and see, to have insight and understanding, to be wise, we've got to take the journey of exploration, of investigation, of looking deeply into our human condition and what life is like. So this Buddhist teaching of putting foremost the importance of understanding through direct investigation rather than belief, rather than blind belief, rather than dogma, rather than doctrine, you know, just really respecting the capacity of the human being, you and I, to take on the role of the explorer, to look and investigate and come to these deep understandings. He merely says, look in this direction, see what you see. So the first thing, you know, he says, what are these troubles that we experience? And how can we free ourselves from these troubles? Now, in this discourse that the Buddha gave, he starts off with one of the highest If you wish, it's like climbing the highest mountain first. It's the one of the highest goals. And he puts that forward as the first thing that we need to do. And I thought, wow, you know, that's kind of hard to start there. Why don't we start somewhere easier? And so I'm going to leave that to the end of the talk, and I'm going to start somewhere else with some really simple things. So how can we free ourselves from troubles, some troubles? One of the easy things that the Buddha gave was restraint. And especially for Buddhist monks and nuns, as I said, living very specialized lives, one of them being that they're celibate. And you must understand that often people who become monks and nuns do so when they're quite young, meaning in their 20s, still very young, virile young people. And it's difficult to live a life of renunciation. I ordained when I was 23. I can't say that it was easy. I was very glad for the guidelines given by the Buddha to help one live according to one's aspiration with the least trouble by having certain tools. And one of them was sense restraint. And in particular, I'm going to share with you a question that is often asked of me. And, you know, this is immature people. I hope you won't be offended. They say, like, well, you know, 23, I mean, what did you do? Like, you know, you're celibate. Is that hard? It's very hard. For young people, that is probably the most difficult discipline to practice, to live a life of chastity and celibacy. And they said, what the Buddha said was sense restraint. Restraining what we take in as sensory information. We are conditioned. Our states of mind and our emotions, we think that, you know, they're so real, but they are conditioned a lot, considerably, by the environment. And so for Buddhist monks and nuns, what's one of the most fundamental teachings that they are expected to practice is sense restraint. Restraining what one looks at and dwells on visually, what one listens to, what one eats, what one smells, what one feels. Living in a way where we're responsible. We know the consequences. Now, as lay people, I'm not suggesting that we live a celibate life, but I'm just going to suggest that a degree of restraint is good. And a restraint of the senses, in particular, the sense of the mind, because in Buddhist teachings, in the Buddhist world of experience, the mind is considered just as another sense. Just like seeing, just like hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. There is the mind as a sense that partakes of the sensory world and creates other things. So the restraint of the mind is foremost really important, because the mind can be our best friend and it can be our worst enemy. Nobody inflicts more trouble on us than our own mind. If you don't believe me, you haven't been watching. And that's the trouble. We don't observe. We don't have sufficient self-awareness to know what we are doing, what we are creating with the mind. So let me begin by just suggesting that we notice how we dwell in the mind. Like, what does the mind, what sort of stuff does it dwell on? What does it think about? And point out two useless areas of dwelling where we could restrain the mind and thereby avoid a lot of trouble, mental trouble. One is dwelling on the past. What we've done wrong, all the mistakes, what they did to us, what they shouldn't have done to us. This way of dwelling, many of us, some people more than others, but many of us spend a good part of our life going over and over what has happened in the past. And generating, by the way we think about it and recollect it, either a lot of remorse and regret, or a lot of resentment and ill will. And I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but I just ask that you consider, during the day or during your week, how much time do you dwell on what they did, what your so-and-so did, and how unfair it was, and how badly you were treated, and how much wrong was done to you, and how, as you dwell on those memories, you generate this sense of indignant, resentment, and ill will towards these people, that place, that situation. Is that a happy state? Are you creating a very pleasant abiding, or are you just creating a lot of trouble for yourself? See it. Why go there? Why create that? Sense restraint. Restrain the mind. You see the mind starting out of habit to go in that direction? No, thank you. I don't feel like it today. I don't feel like putting my hand in the fire today. You know, it kind of burnt yesterday. Or what you did wrong. And we have, we know all our flaws, all our faults. Nobody knows you better than you do yourself. However, you don't necessarily know yourself in a balanced way, because we do tend to see ourselves with a great deal of bias. And the bias can be positive or negative. When you're feeling a little, you start looking back at what you did wrong, this critical faculty coming up, then you see all the bad things that, about you. All the things that you did wrong that were not good, not fair, not virtuous, or not honorable, or not sensitive, not generous. And what do you experience? You start having this tremendous sense of remorse and guilt, and you're not worth anything. You become really depressed. And that is, again, a waste of your energy, a waste of your time. It does no good. If there is something to learn from the past, and you remember I made a mistake, acknowledge the mistake. Learn from that experience so that you may go forth and not repeat the mistake. Don't sink in the mire of dwelling with remorse on what has gone past. It's gone. It cannot be changed. It's happened. You can change what needs to be done now. So this is one area of restraint, self-awareness, knowing this tendency of the mind to kind of repeat things over and over again, generating remorse and regret. Restrain the mind from that. Free ourselves from that burden. The other tendency is to race to the future. And I spoke on this at length during my talk at Theosophist, how we can generate so much anxiety and worry about the future, because it being uncertain, and we know it's uncertain, and we feel that we're frightened. We're frightened of what may happen. And so we then try to find assurance from somewhere or something. And there is no insurance or assurance as to what the future is going to bring. I mean, the future is unknown, or it is uncertain, if you wish. I know that many of us believe in many ways of, considering what the future is going to bring. It's still uncertain. The future is uncertain. The future has to be uncertain. If the future is not uncertain, life is meaningless. Me having the will and the capacity to make a choice is meaningless. So the future has to be uncertain. And the price for that is that I have free choice to a degree. I can choose how I live. And therefore, willing to accept that the future is uncertain, rise up to the occasion and accept that it's uncertain, but don't rush ahead with this mind that's going to generate all sorts of possibilities, speculation, anticipation, and fear and dread and anxiety and what. Let it be uncertain. Let it come to you. We're not going to it. We're going to stay here and look after the present. And that's where we apply our energy and our effort. So we notice this tendency of the mind to race to the future and generate all sorts of frightening scenarios. We restrain. We stop ourselves from doing that because we see it as a useless endeavor, a useless preoccupation. So that sense restraint that can free us from a great deal of the normal troubles of mind that many of us live with almost on a daily basis. Remorse, regret, anxiety, and worry. Now, if you get rid of those, you're already doing pretty well. And you can certainly reduce them just by a simple thing, self-awareness and self-restraint, restraint of the mind, how the mind dwells, what the mind races out to. And you do so through understanding, if you've observed this process of the mind, through self-awareness. So through restraint, we can free ourselves from a great deal of unnecessary troubles of mind. Another way that the Buddha suggested was proper use. Proper use. We're alive. We're human beings with human bodies, material bodies in a material world with material needs. And the Buddha recognized this and he said, well, you know, to live, you definitely need some basic requisites. And the Buddha said that the four basic requisites for life, for existence, for the ability to continue in this physical form in a reasonably comfortable way, is to have sufficient food, clothing, shelter, and medicines. The Buddha was more far-sighted than just the three basic requisites for life. Medicines of various forms are requisites. We need those things in order to be able to live. We need clothing, especially in Chicago in winter. You need shelter, and we need food, and we need, yeah, medicines, because we do get sick. And so what the Buddha said, hey, you need these things, proper use. Know the proper use of these things. The body has needs. That's not a problem. For us, there should be no problem. All of us have our needs met. What's the problem? The body's needs are met. What's the problem is that the mind, unrestrained and undisciplined and, let's say, rather foolish, creates a lot of craving. So just a simple thing like food. How much suffering, how much mental anguish and trouble do people experience over food? And I'm not talking about people who are starving to death or starving through lack of food. Their problems are pretty simple. It's through lack of food. Our problem is not that. So why is there so much problem, so much mental anguish about something so simple as food? Because we don't know the proper use of food. Let me just read to you what the proper use of food. It's kind of interesting, some of these things. I have to find it first. obviously, I'm not. Here it is. Considering wisely, he makes use of food. Neither for pleasure, nor for intoxication, neither for beauty, nor adornment, but but only for the support and to sustain this body, so that one can be free from hunger and pursue the spiritual life, or a life of goodness. And that should be pretty simple. So why is there so much problem around just food? So many people just seem to have to be continually preoccupied with the food that I have to eat, don't have to eat. How can I stop myself from eating this food? How can I stop myself from eating that food? And on it goes. And it gets to be, very dreary to listen to the latest diet or what's good for you or what's not good. My friends, I'm not one who knows much about diets. All I know is my body needs food. And what I really can suggest is listen to your body. Listen to your body. Your body tells you when you're thirsty. It tells you when you're thirsty. How does it tell you? It just talks to you. It's thirsty. Give it something to drink. Your body tells you when it's hungry. And it also, if you listen carefully, will actually tell you what type of food it needs. I know I've said this to other people and they think that I'm a bit off and it doesn't make much sense, but my body talks to me in that way. I have an urge to eat something and I just have to stop and notice what it feels like. What sort of thing would the body respond to? And it seems to tell me the kind of the sort of, not, doesn't say, oh, get this particular, brand of that. It's the type of food. And my body responds to it. And so I find that the reason that many of us have trouble with food is that we have lost contact with the body. And we've, developed so many overlays of acting on craving rather than on the body's needs. We act on what craving, what the mind is saying we want. And then the body's messages get all confused. And so food becomes something that's, an indulgence that leads to all sorts of health problems and, health problems that create a lot of mental problems. So food should be something very simple. Not that it has to be neglected, but it's just a necessity for life. We don't live to eat. We eat to live, and to live for a purpose. And we shouldn't spend all our time worrying about diet and this food or that food. And sufficient attention. Eat to live. Live a good life. Eat for your body, not for your craving. So this is the proper use of food, the proper use of clothing. You need clothes. I need clothes. How much of what do you need? And all I'm going to suggest is that we try and break out, escape from the enslavement that we find ourselves victims of, the enslavement of this very materialistic society that is continually conditioning and reinforcing that conditioning that we are consumers. That's what we've been put here for, to consume more and more. And so we approach life, simple things like clothes, shoes, pants, a shirt, a dress. And all of a sudden, it's not just clothes to look decent and to keep you warm and to, be presentable. It becomes an issue of tremendous fashion statements. It becomes who you are. It identifies you with certain stature or standing. And people spend a tremendous amount of money on it. And of course, if you're going to spend a tremendous amount of money, you've got to make that money or you've got to find that money. So you end up being in debt, working extra hard, a second job, a third job, for the basic requisites, food, clothing, shelter. So I suggest that we have not, our purpose in life is not to be here in order to be good consumers or, consuming in abundance, but rather we're here to, for a purpose. And the true purpose is to live a good life that's of benefit to us and others and enables us to continue on our spiritual growth. So the basic requisites for life should not be such a difficult thing for us. Do we need a mansion? Do you need the best and most expensive clothes? Do you need to have the newest car? Do we need to have the best? How much can you afford? How much energy do you want to invest in those things? Do we want to accumulate, a house full of ornaments and artwork and precious things? Do you need that? If you do, you've got to really devote a lot of energy and effort, and you're going to have a lot of trouble. You're going to have a lot of trouble to acquire. You're going to have a lot of trouble to maintain. The bigger the house, the more cleaning. The more clothes you've got, the more you've got to look after. And of course, if you say, well, I enjoy looking after my things. Okay, well, that's all right. If you enjoy it, that's fine. I'm not here to, suggest that you should live at a certain standard, high or low. All I'm suggesting is that we reflect and not just act habitually or being conditioned. Do we experience any trouble in our minds? Do we feel burdened by the simple things of life, like food, like clothing, like shelter? One of the areas is money, of course. If you say, well, no, I don't, those things don't concern me. It's just that I don't have enough money. Well, that's a big problem, because the more you need, or the more you decide you need, then the more you have to acquire, and the more you have to pay for, and the more debt you usually undertake, and the more worry, and the more tension, and the more stress, and the more anxiety, and the more mental trouble. Bodies have needs. I think we can meet those needs quite simply. It's the mind that has cravings, and a lot of those cravings lead to a lot of problems, and they're self-inflicted. Consider that. Another area that the Buddha suggested we can, free ourselves from troubles is through avoidance. Avoiding certain things. And in his story there in the text, it's said in India, he says to avoid wild elephants, avoid tigers, avoid dogs with rabies, avoid snakes, avoid... I ran into a tiger as I was coming in tonight. I was scared. I ran for my life. It's not literally relevant in that sense. But how many things do we get involved in that create a lot of trouble for us that we could avoid? How much do you volunteer to get involved in? How much do you undertake, do you overcommit of your time, of your energy, of your resources, of your finances, voluntarily get involved in stuff? And then you feel stressed, you feel overwhelmed, you can't cope. I teach at the college, I see students all the time like this. They just overcommit. They got jobs so they can afford to have a car, so they can have girlfriends to go out and spend money, and then they try to study and they can't finish their homework, and then they're behind, and then they're going to get dropped, and then their financial aid is going to... It's just overcommitting beyond one's ability, beyond one's resources. Avoid that. Know your resources of time and energy and attention. Use it wisely. Use it so that it will bring some benefit for you, and you can live at ease and live in comfort without being burdened. Just simple things with time management. You know, avoid being overly kind of late on things. Avoid coming to work late. Avoid finishing your work late. Avoid getting into an argument with your boss. Avoid texting while you're driving. It's very stressful and creates problems. Avoid having those arguments that have no point, no purpose, an argument over the simplest little thing. How many arguments you have at home with your wife or with your children over really silly things that are of no great consequence? We can avoid that. And we'll just avoid it by not going there, by recognizing that it's a waste of time and energy. So, you know, self-awareness. Another area is endurance. Unfortunately, we have developed our, degree of ability to control the environment, to control things to such an extent that we've become extremely, kind of timid. Now and the slightest discomfort, the slightest pain, the slightest thing, the slightest little thing, we feel it's unbearable. We've made ourselves very weak. We're not that weak. We can endure some things that have to be endured. If something comes to us, we're not looking for it. If something comes to us, aches and pains, and if you're asked to work and it's hot, if it's the air conditioner breaks down and it's hot, or it's cold and you're asked to go out and shovel the snow, we can endure discomforts. If there's an illness and medicine can't relieve it and there is no, we can endure it. We can be brave if we so choose. We've done it on many occasions and we can do it again whenever it is necessary. So to live on this planet, the human condition is that we will have to endure some discomfort. If you expect to be able to live with no discomfort, pain, or loss, or negative kind of experience on the sensory level, you're in the wrong place. You've come to the wrong place. Life is pain and pleasure, birth and death, health and sickness. That's just the way life is. So we must be able to endure some little things, or as much as is necessary. And so we don't need to be afraid, always this timidity, the timid fear of what's going to come, and the thought that I cannot endure the slightest little discomfort. We can't endure a lot. So some things we endure. Then the Buddha said there are things that we have to abandon. And this is similar to the restraint. You know, abandoning those negative states of mind. Many of us feel as if we're the victims of something that we're the victim. You know, the world makes me feel sad. The world makes me feel depressed. The world makes me feel angry. The world makes me feel frightened. The world is just the way the world is. What you feel, what you create in the mind is yours and mine. This is our creation. When we create anger, it's our anger. Nobody makes you angry. So when we recognize a creation in the mind that's negative, we're dwelling on some negative state, be it anger, being envy, jealousy, any of these. These are negative states of mind that drag us down, wear us out, weaken our immune system, detract from our sense of well-being, detract from happiness. And what we have in us is what we bring to the world. So we become very, very unpleasant guests. So get rid of those states of mind. Don't dwell on them. We can, through, again, the recognition that the state of mind is generated from a perception, maybe a memory, maybe a projection, and then dwelling through thinking about it. That's what generates these moods and these mental states and these emotions. And we can change that. We can change our inner environment. We can change our inner ecology. We can change our inner world of the mind states and emotions by being attentive and by having developed some degree of control, or if you wish, mastery over the way the mind works. And so this is what the Buddha next says, is there are certain, you know, we need to develop some things in order to be able to do this. And what he says to develop are certain mental attributes, qualities of the mind, in particular awareness, mindfulness. Without self-awareness, there is no possibility of seeing ourselves, knowing ourselves, nor is there any possibility of choosing our destiny through choosing what we create. It is awareness that allows us to see ourselves. And this is one of the fundamental qualities. He called it a factor of enlightenment. It leads to enlightenment. The other one was investigation, observing and looking deeply to see how it works. What's this? Where does this come from? Where does it lead to? What's the cause? What's the results? What's the relationship? Really look at this closely. The mind that need not be such a mystery to us if we have awareness and if we look and reflect. To reflect means to observe the relationships there. Generating interest in this introspection. Generating interest in contemplation and meditation. Generating energy, devoting time and effort to this practice. So that then we begin to arouse the joy that comes from revelations. Revelations not from outside, but as we see ourselves and understand, oh, this is what anger is. Oh, this is what remorse is. Oh, this is how I create this particular mental state. Oh, this is how I behave. Well, what do you know? And you feel a sense of joy also in the sense, oh, now I have a choice. I have an option, a freedom. And if you train yourself through, you know, meditation is a practice which requires a regular practice and a regular commitment to strengthen the quality of awareness and to start developing more focus, more concentration. Concentration is the power to direct our attention and thereby direct our thinking. And that's what gives us the power to, you know, change the world that we create within ourselves. And this concentration that we develop through meditation is always associated with serenity. It's got nothing to do with crushing, defeating, thrashing, bashing willpower and force. It comes from a gradual training with effort, guiding the mind so that it unburdens itself of all the unnecessary proliferations, discursive thinking, and begins to experience the state of stillness and silence with great focus. and that is restful to the mind. It's joyful, restful, blissful. And that mind, so trained, is then able to do the work that needs to be done if we want to free ourselves from the greatest source or the root source of all troubles, which is ignorance, a deep misunderstanding regarding what we are and who we are and what our purpose is here. And this is especially pertinent to the Theosophical Society, my friends. So the last of the Buddha said was, there are troubles that have to be gotten rid of through insight, through direct insight, knowledge and vision of a reality that is beyond thinking, that is beyond learning from anywhere. It is only realized when the mind is fit for the task of being attentive in a way that is penetrating and can arrive at some direct knowledge and vision. And to do this, it does require quite a lot of training. And the Buddha often called this mental training as developing samatha and vipassana, as developing tranquility and insight. And some of these things are to do, they're in the Eightfold Path, developing mindfulness, making effort, developing concentration. That's getting the mind to a state where it can do this work. And this is what we should be doing, rather than applying our mind in what the Buddha termed as useless preoccupations. Let me quote. This is really good. By reflecting on things that should not be reflected on, he creates an awful lot of problems. And what does he reflect unwisely on? Things like this. Did I exist in the past? Did I not exist in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what, did I become what in the past? Shall I exist in the future? Shall I not exist in the future? What shall I be in the future? How shall I be in the future? Having been what, shall I become what in the future? Or, now at the present time, he is doubtful about himself. Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Whence came this person? Whither will he go? When he reflects unwisely in this way, one of six false views arises in him. I have a self. This view arises in him as true and real. Or, I have no self. This view arises in him as being true and real. Or, by self, I perceive self. This view arises as being true and real. Or, by self, I perceive non-self. This view arises as being true and real. Or, by non-self, I perceive self. This view arises as being true or real. Or a wrong view arises in him as follows. This myself, which speaks and feels, which experiences the fruits of good and bad actions, now here, now there, this self is permanent, stable, everlasting, unchanging, remaining the same forever and ever. This is what is called becoming enmeshed in views, a jungle of views, a wilderness of views, scuffling in views, the agitation, struggle of views, the fetter of views. For this type of person, there's never freedom from trouble. How much of our, you know, what we call spiritual study, you know, our spiritual path is preoccupied with this kind of philosophizing studying, be it the doctrine, be it Buddhist texts. I mean, this is a very good one for me because I have been called at times as being one of those born again Theravada Buddhist, very rigid in his view of Buddhism. But I take that with a grain of salt, of course. I don't believe it. But this one, I have no self. You know, this is a teaching of Buddhism that's pretty standard doctrine, is the Buddhist teaching of no self. But this view, if I go around and say, I have no self, I'm a Buddhist, I have no self, and I believe that this is, that I have had an insight into, I understand something, that's a thicket of views. That's just another view, and it's going to create as many problems as any other view. The Buddha is not interested in these views. We're not going to come to an end of this speculative seeking and trying to understand reality by this means. What the Buddha said was needed was to direct one's reflection on the Four Noble Truths, and the last of the Four Noble Truths is the path to come to knowledge and vision, and the core of that path is developing clarity of mind, focus of mind, that enables us to see directly reality rather than thinking about reality, speculating about reality, pontificating about reality, writing books about reality, lecturing about reality. I've done all those things. But if we really want to be sincere seekers, and if we want to receive the fruit that is possible for a sincere seeker, which is arriving at the knowledge and vision of this reality, which is entering the stream, which is the arising of right view, which is not a view of belief or any idea. It's through direct experience that frees us from any conceit or view regarding a self or non-self or whatever, that frees us from any these blind beliefs in rituals or superstitious practices as to how we can attain liberation, that frees us from doubt with regards what is the path of liberation. For this immersion, for this realization, we do need to cultivate the mind that can break through the bubble, break through the shell. And so I do say that for all of us, one of the very important requirements to be free from troubles of mind is to devote a good portion of our time to a sincere and humble practice, regular practice of cultivating the mind in samatha and vipassana, in tranquility and insight, in being able to establish the mind in stillness, in clarity and focus, and just with the sincere, humble desire to see without any precondition. And this will bring us to a freedom of a good portion of our troubles in life. So, my friends, that's my reflection on the Buddhist discourse on freeing ourselves from troubles. Some of it, you know, the early things are quite pertinent, but try to keep in mind that here in the Theosophical Society, we do devote a great deal of time on study. I'm not here to criticize that. Study is to give us guidelines. But I really would like us to devote more time to practice, of, in particular, meditation. My teacher used to say, study 5%, practice 95%. It's hard to do. But I think it's good to keep in mind and at least try to do something. Thank you very much for your patience and attention. I've gone over my time maybe, but if there are questions and people are willing to stay a little longer, I will take questions.
Any questions from here? Wait for the microphone.
We do have one question already from cyberspace, so. You suggest we stop being a consumer and worrying about material comforts, but won't that hurt America and our economy? How will we have jobs if everyone renounces consumerism? What do you replace it with?
That's the problem. You see, we've built a society that's not sustainable. I mean, we've built a consumer society is not sustainable. At this level of consumerism, it's just not sustainable. If, what's this small population of America, 300 million, and we've got 7 billion people in the world. Is it sustainable? it is a valid question, and I'm not here to say I have the answer. Believe me. It's not that I have an answer. I just see a problem, and what I see is on an individual basis, I will choose to make my choices for me and maybe my family in terms of how I invest my energy, in terms of how I invest my resources. And, you know, we all do that. So on an individual basis, I can do something. I consume, but I consume in a way that doesn't create too much trouble for me. And, maybe not too much trouble for the planet. But each person will have to come to their comfort zone. And I'm not here to impose any level on anyone. I'm just pointing out a relationship, the consequences. And I think that's a good start. As a whole, if you start looking at these things as on a large scale, it's really, really difficult. If we would all become monks and nuns, America would be a very peaceful place. But in a lot of trouble. But it's never happened yet, so I'm not going to worry about it.